idol of the garden. Or again, the supremely concentrated future Buddha breaking past the last horizons of the created world. The same archetypal images are activated, symbolizing danger, reassurance, trial, passage, and the strange holiness of the mysteries of birth. The disgusting and rejected frog or dragon of the fairy tale brings up the sunball in its mouth. For the frog, the serpent, the rejected one, is the representative of that unconscious deep, so deep that the bottom cannot be seen, wherein are hoarded all of the rejected, unadmitted, unrecognized, unknown, or undeveloped factors, laws, and elements of existence. Those are the pearls of the fabled submarine palaces of the Nixies, Tritons, and Water Guardians, the jewels that give light to the demon cities of the underworld, the fire seeds in the ocean of immortality, which supports the earth and surrounds it like a snake. The stars in the bosom of immortal night. Those are the nuggets in the gold hoard of the dragon, the guarded apples of the Hesperides, the filaments of the golden fleece. The herald or announcer of the adventure, therefore, is often dark, loathly, or terrifying, judged evil by the world. Yet, if one could follow, the way would be opened through the walls of day into the dark, where the jewels glow. Or the herald is a beast, as in the fairy tale, representative of the repressed instinctual fecundity within ourselves, or again a veiled mysterious figure, the unknown. The story is told, for example, of King Arthur, and how he made him ready with many knights to ride a hunting.
As soon as he was in the forest, the king saw a great hart afore him. "This hart will I chase," said King Arthur, and so he spurred the horse, and rode after long, and so by fine force he was like to have smitten the hart. Whereas the king had chased the hart so long that his horse lost his breath and fell down dead. Then a yeoman fetched the king another horse. So the king saw the hart embushed, and his horse dead. He set him down by a fountain, and there he fell in great thoughts. And as he sat so, him thought he heard a noise of hounds, to the sum of 30. And with that the king saw, coming toward him, the strangest beast that ever he saw or heard of. So the beast went to the well and drank, and the noise was in the beast's belly like unto the questing of 30 couple hounds. But all the while the beast drank, there was no noise in the beast's belly. And therewith the beast departed with a great noise, whereof the king had great marvel.
For we have the case, from a very different portion of the world, of an Arapaho girl of the North American plains. She spied a porcupine near a cottonwood tree. She tried to hit the animal, but it ran behind the tree and began to climb. The girl started after, to catch it, but it continued just out of reach. "Well," she said, "I am climbing to catch the porcupine, for I want those quills, and if necessary, I will go to the top." The porcupine reached the top of the tree, but as she approached and was about to lay hands on it, the cottonwood tree suddenly lengthened, and the porcupine resumed his climb. Looking down, she saw her friends craning up at her and beckoning her to descend. But having passed under the influence of the porcupine, and fearful for the great distance between herself and the ground, she continued to mount the tree until she became the merest speck to those looking from below, and with the porcupine she finally reached the sky. Two dreams will suffice to illustrate the spontaneous appearance of the figure of the herald in the psyche that is ripe for transformation. The first is the dream of a young man seeking the way to a new world orientation. "I am in a green land where many sheep are at pasture. It is the land of sheep. In the land of sheep stands an unknown woman and points the way. The second is the dream of a young girl whose girl companion has lately died of consumption. She is afraid that she may have the disease herself. I was in a blossoming garden. The sun was just going down with a blood-red glow. Then there appeared before me a black, noble knight, who spoke to me with a very serious, deep, and frightening voice. "Wilt thou go with me?" Without attending my answer, he took me by the hand and carried me away. Whether dream or myth, in these adventures there is an atmosphere of irresistible fascination about the figure that appears suddenly as guide, marking a new period, a new stage in the biography. That which has to be faced, and is somehow profoundly familiar to the unconscious, though unknown, surprising, and even frightening to the conscious personality, makes itself known. And what formerly was meaningful may become strangely emptied of value, like the world of the king's child, with the sudden disappearance into the well of the golden ball. Thereafter, even though the hero returns for a while to his familiar occupations, they may be found unfruitful. A series of signs of increasing force then will become visible, until, as in the following legend of The Four Signs, which is the most celebrated example of the call to adventure in the literature of the world, the summons can no longer be denied. The young prince, Gautama Shakyamuni, the future Buddha, had been protected by his father from all knowledge of age, sickness, death, or monkhood, lest he should be moved to thoughts of life renunciation, for it had been prophesied at his birth that he was to become either a world emperor or a Buddha. The king, prejudiced in favor of the royal vocation, provided his son with 3 palaces and 40,000 dancing girls to keep his mind attached to the world. But these only served to advance the inevitable. For while still relatively young, the youth exhausted for himself the fields of fleshly joy and became ripe for the other experience. The moment he was ready, the proper heralds automatically appeared.
Now, on a certain day, the future Buddha wished to go to the park, and told his charioteer to make ready the chariot. Accordingly, the man brought out a sumptuous and elegant chariot, and, adorning it richly, he harnessed to it 4 state horses of the Sindhava breed, as white as the petals of the white lotus, and announced to the future Buddha that everything was ready. And the future Buddha mounted the chariot, which was like to a palace of the gods, and proceeded toward the park. "The time for the enlightenment of the Prince Siddhartha draweth nigh," thought the gods. "We must show him a sign." And they changed one of their number into a decrepit old man, broken-toothed, grey-haired, crooked and bent of body, leaning on a staff and trembling, and showed him to the future Buddha, but so that only he and the charioteer saw him. Then said the future Buddha to the charioteer, "Friend, pray, who is this man? Even his hair is not like that of other men." And when he heard the answer, he said, "Shame on birth, since to everyone that is born old age must come." And agitated in heart, he thereupon returned and ascended his palace. "Why has my son returned so quickly?" asked the king. "Sire, he has seen an old man," was the reply. "And because he has seen an old man, he is about to retire from the world." "Do you want to kill me that you say such things? Quickly, get ready some plays to be performed before my son. If we can but get him to enjoying pleasure, he will cease to think of retiring from the world." Then the king extended the guard to 1/2 league in each direction. Again, on a certain day, as the future Buddha was going to the park, he saw a diseased man whom the gods had fashioned. And having again made inquiry, he returned, agitated in heart, and descended his palace. And the king made the same inquiry and gave the same order as before, and again, extending the guard, placed them for 3/4 of a league around. And again on a certain day, as the future Buddha was going to the park, he saw a dead man whom the gods had fashioned. And, having again made inquiry, he returned, agitated in heart, and descended his palace. And the king made the same inquiry and gave the same orders as before, and again extending the guard, placed them for a league around. And again on a certain day, as the future Buddha was going to the park, he saw a monk, carefully and decently clad, whom the gods had fashioned. And he asked his charioteer, "Pray, who is this man?" "Sire, this is one who has retired from the world." And the charioteer thereupon proceeded to sound the praises of retirement from the world. The thought of retiring from the world was a pleasing one to the future Buddha.
This first stage of the mythological journey, which we have designated the call to adventure, signifies that destiny has summoned the hero and transferred his spiritual center of gravity from within the pale of his society to a zone unknown. This fateful region of both treasure and danger may be variously represented as a distant land, a forest, a kingdom underground, beneath the waves or above the sky, a secret island, lofty mountaintop, or profound dream state. But it is always a place of strangely fluid and polymorphous beings, unimaginable torments, superhuman deeds, and impossible delight. The hero can go forth of his own volition to accomplish the adventure, as did Theseus when he arrived in his father's city Athens and heard the horrible history of the Minotaur. Or he may be carried or sent abroad by some benign or malignant agent, as was Odysseus, driven about the Mediterranean by the winds of the angered god Poseidon. The adventure may begin as a mere blunder, as did that of the princess of the fairy tale. Or still again, one may be only casually strolling, when some passing phenomenon catches the wandering eye and lures one away from the frequented paths of man. Examples might be multiplied ad infinitum from every corner of the world.
In the above section, and throughout the following pages, I have made no attempt to exhaust the evidence. Two have done so, after the manner, for example, of Fraser in The Golden Bough, would have enlarged my chapters prodigiously without making the main line of the monomyth any clearer. Instead, I am giving in each section a few striking examples from a number of widely scattered representative traditions. During the course of the work, I shift my sources gradually, so that the reader may savor the peculiar qualities of the various styles. By the time he comes to the last page, he will have reviewed an immense number of mythologies.
2. Refusal of the call. Often in actual life, and not infrequently in the myths and popular tales, we encounter the dull case of the call unanswered, for it is always possible to turn the ear to other interests. Refusal of the summons converts the adventure into its negative. Walled in boredom, hard work, or culture, the subject loses the power of significant affirmative action and becomes a victim to be saved. His flowering world becomes a wasteland of dry stones, and his life feels meaningless, even though, like King Minos, he may, through titanic effort, succeed in building an empire of renown. Whatever house he builds, it will be a house of death, a labyrinth of cyclopean walls to hide from him his Minotaur. All he can do is create new problems for himself and await the gradual approach of his disintegration. "Because I have called and ye refused, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh as desolation, and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish cometh upon you. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. Time Jesum transeuntum et non revertentum. Dread the passage of Jesus, for he does not return. The myths and folk tales of the whole world make clear that the refusal is essentially a refusal to give up what one takes to be one's own interest. The future is regarded not in terms of an unremitting series of deaths and births, but as though one's present system of ideals, virtues, goals, and advantages were to be fixed and made secure. King Minos retained the divine bull, when the sacrifice would have signified submission to the will of the god of his society, for he preferred what he conceived to be his economic advantage. Thus he failed to advance into the life role that he had assumed, and we have seen with what calamitous effect. The divinity itself became his terror, for, obviously, if one is oneself one's god, then God himself, the will of God, the power that would destroy one's egocentric system, becomes a monster.
I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. And in the midst of tears, I hid from him and under running laughter.
One is harassed both day and night by the divine being that is the image of the living self within the locked labyrinth of one's own disoriented psyche. The ways to the gates have all been lost. There is no exit. One can only cling, like Satan, furiously to one's self and be in hell, or else break and be annihilate at last in God.
Ah, fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom thou seekest. Thou dravest love from thee, who dravest me. Francis Thompson, The Hound of Heaven.
The same harrowing, mysterious voice was to be heard in the call of the Greek Apollo to the fleeing maiden Daphne, daughter of the river Peneus, as he pursued her over the plain. O nymph! O Peneus' daughter, stay! The deity called to her, like the frog to the princess of the fairy tale.
I who pursue thee am no enemy. Thou knowest not whom thou fleest, and for that reason dost thou flee. Run with less speed, I pray, and hold thy flight. I too will follow with less speed. Nay, stop and ask who thy lover is. He would have said more, the story goes, but the maiden pursued her frightened way and left him with words unfinished, even in her desertion seeming fair. The winds bared her limbs, the opposing breezes set her garments aflutter as she ran, and a light air flung her locks streaming behind her. Her beauty was enhanced by flight, but the chase drew to an end, for the youthful god would not longer waste his time in coaxing words, and urged on by love, he pursued at utmost speed. Just as when a Gallic hound has seen a hare in an open plain and seeks his prey on flying feet, but the hare, safety. He, just about to fasten on her, now, even now, thinks he has her, and grazes her very heels with his outstretched muzzle. But she knows not whether or not she be already caught, and barely escapes from those sharp fangs, and leaves behind the jaws just closing on her. So ran the god and maid. He sped by hope, and she by fear. But he ran the more swiftly, borne on the wings of love, gave her no time to rest, hung over her fleeing shoulders, and breathed on the hair that streamed over her neck. Now was her strength all gone, and pale with fear and utterly overcome by the toil of her swift flight, seeing the waters of her father's river near, she cried, "O father, help! If your waters hold divinity, change and destroy this beauty by which I pleased o'erwell." Scarce had she thus prayed, when a down-dragging numbness seized her limbs, and her soft sides were begirt with thin bark. Her hair was changed to leaves, her arms to branches. Her feet, but now so swift, grew fast in sluggish roots, and her head was now but a tree's top. Her gleaming beauty alone remained.
This is indeed a dull and unrewarding finish. Apollo, the sun, the lord of time and ripeness, no longer pressed his frightening suit, but instead simply named the laurel his favorite tree, and ironically recommended its leaves to the fashioners of victory wreaths. The girl had retreated to the image of her parent, and there found protection. Like the unsuccessful husband whose dream of mother love preserved him from the state of cleaving to a wife. The literature of psychoanalysis abounds in examples of such desperate fixations. What they represent is an impotence to put off the infantile ego, with its sphere of emotional relationships and ideals. One is bound in by the walls of childhood. The father and mother stand as threshold guardians, and the timorous soul, fearful of some punishment, fails to make the passage through the door and come to birth in the world without. Dr. Jung has reported a dream that resembles very closely the image of the myth of Daphne. The dreamer is the same young man who found himself in the land of the sheep, the land, that is to say, of unindependence. A voice within him says, "I must first get away from the father." And then a few nights later, a snake draws a circle about the dreamer, and he stands like a tree, grown fast to the earth. This is an image of the magic circle drawn about the personality by the dragon power of the fixating parent. The serpent, in mythology a symbol of the terrestrial waters, corresponds precisely to Daphne's father, the river Peneus. Brunhild, in the same way, was protected in her virginity, arrested in her daughter's state for years, by the circle of the fire of All-Father Wotan. She slept in timelessness until the coming of Siegfried. Little Briar Rose, Sleeping Beauty, was put to sleep by a jealous hag, an unconscious evil mother image. And not only the child, her entire world went off to sleep. But at last, after long, long years, there came a prince to wake her.
The king and queen, the conscious good parent images, who had just come home and were entering the hall, began to fall asleep, and with them the whole estate. All the horses slept in the stalls, the dogs in the yard, the pigeons on the roof, the flies on the walls. Yes, the fire that flickered on the hearth grew still and slumbered, and the roast ceased to simmer. And the cook, who was about to pull the hair of the scullery boy because he had forgotten something, let him go and fell off to sleep. And the wind went down, and not a leaf stirred in the trees. Then, around the castle, a hedge of thorns began to grow, which became taller every year, and finally shut off the whole estate. It grew up taller than the castle, so that nothing more was seen, not even the weathercock on the roof.
A Persian city once was enstoned to stone. King and queen, soldiers, inhabitants and all, because its people refused the call of Allah. Lot's wife became a pillar of salt for looking back when she had been summoned forth from her city by Jehovah. And there is the tale of the wandering Jew, cursed to remain on earth until the day of judgment, because when Christ had passed him carrying the cross, this man among the people standing along the way called, "Go faster, a little speed." The unrecognized, insulted Savior turned and said to him, "I go, but you shall be waiting here for me when I return." Some of the victims remained spellbound forever, at least so far as we are told, but others are destined to be saved. Brunhild was preserved for her proper hero, and little Briar Rose was rescued by a prince. Also, the young man transformed into a tree dreamed subsequently of the unknown woman who pointed the way, as a mysterious guide to paths unknown. Not all who hesitate are lost. The psyche has many secrets in reserve, and these are not disclosed unless required. So it is that sometimes the predicament following an obstinate refusal of the call proves to be the occasion of a providential revelation of some unsuspected principle of release. Willed introversion, in fact, is one of the classic implements of creative genius and can be employed as a deliberate device. It drives the psychic energies into depth and activates the lost continent of unconscious, infantile, and archetypal images. The result, of course, may be a disintegration of consciousness more or less complete, neurosis, psychosis, the plight of spellbound Daphne. But on the other hand, if the personality is able to absorb and integrate the new forces, there will be experienced an almost superhuman degree of self-consciousness and masterful control. This is a basic principle of the Indian disciplines of yoga. It has been the way, also, of many creative spirits in the West. It cannot be described quite as an answer to any specific call. Rather, it is a deliberate, terrific refusal to respond to anything but the deepest, highest, richest answer to the as-yet-unknown demand of some waiting void within, a kind of total strike or rejection of the offered terms of life, as a result of which some power of transformation carries the problem to a plane of new magnitudes where it is suddenly and finally resolved. This is the aspect of the hero problem illustrated in the wondrous Arabian Nights adventure of the Prince Kamar al-Zaman and the Princess Budur. The young and handsome prince, the only son of King Shahriman of Persia, persistently refused the repeated suggestions, requests, demands, and finally injunctions of his father that he should do the normal thing and take to himself a wife. The first time the subject was broached to him, the lad responded, "O my father, know that I have no lust to marry, nor doth my soul incline to women. For that concerning their craft and perfidy I have read many books, and heard much talk, even as saith the poet."
"Now, and of women, ask ye?" I reply, "In their affairs I'm versed a doctor rare. When man's head grizzles and his money dwindles, in their affection he hath naught for share."
And another said,
"Rebel against women, and so shalt thou serve Allah the more. The youth who gives women the rein must forfeit all hope to soar. They'll balk him when seeking the strange device Excelsior, though waste he a thousand of years in the study of science and law."
And when he had ended his verses, he continued, "O my father, wedlock is a thing whereto I will never consent, no, not though I drink the cup of death." When the Sultan Shahriman heard these words from his son, light became darkness in his sight, and he was full of grief. Yet, for the great love he bore him, He was unwilling to repeat his wishes, and was not angry, but showed him all manner of kindness. After a year, the father pressed again his question, but the youth persisted in refusal, with further stanzas from the poets. The king consulted with his wazir, and the minister advised,
"O king, wait another year, and if after that thou be minded to speak to him on the matter of marriage, speak not to him privily, but address him on a day of state, when all the emirs and wazirs are present with the whole of the armies standing before thee. And when all are in crowd, then send for thy son, Kamar al-Zaman, and summon him. And, when he cometh, broach to him the matter of marriage before the wazirs and grandees and officers of state and captains, for he will surely be bashful and daunted by their presence, and will not dare to oppose thy will."
When the moment came, however, and King Shahriman gave his command before the state, the prince bowed his head awhile, then raising it towards his father, and, being moved by youthful folly and boyish ignorance, replied, "But for myself I will never marry, no, not though I drink the cup of death. As for thee, thou art great in age and small of wit. Hast thou not twice ere this day, and before this occasion, questioned me of the matter of marriage, and I refused my consent? Indeed thou dotest and art not fit to govern a flock of sheep." So saying, Kamar al-Zaman unclasped his hands from behind his back and tucked up his sleeves above his elbows before his father, being in a fit of fury. Moreover, he added many words to his sire, knowing not what he said, in the trouble of his spirits. The king was confounded and ashamed, since this befell in the presence of his grandees and soldier officers assembled on a high festival and state occasion. But presently, the majesty of kingship took him, and he cried out at his son and made him tremble. Then he called to the guards standing before him and commanded, "Seize him." So they came forward and laid hands on him, and, binding him, brought him before his sire, who bade them pinion his elbows behind his back, and in this guise make him stand before the presence. And the prince bowed down his head for fear and apprehension, and his brow and face were beaded and spangled with sweat, and shame and confusion troubled him sorely. Thereupon his father abused him, and reviled him, and cried, "Woe to thee, thou son of adultery and nursling of abomination! How durst thou answer me in this wise before my captains and soldiers? But hitherto none hath chastised thee. Knowest thou not that this deed thou hast done were a disgrace to him, had it been done by the meanest of my subjects?" And the king ordered his Mamelukes to loose his elbow bonds and imprison him in one of the bastions of the citadel. So they took the prince and thrust him into an old tower in which there was a dilapidated salon, and in its midst a ruined well, after having first swept it and cleansed its floor rags, and set therein a couch on which they laid a mattress, a leathern rug, and a cushion. And then they brought a great lantern and a wax candle, for that place was dark, even by day. And lastly, the Mamelukes led Kamar al-Zaman thither, and stationed a eunuch at the door. And when all this was done, the prince threw himself on the couch, sad-spirited and heavy-hearted, blaming himself and repenting of his injurious conduct to his father. Meanwhile, in the distant empire of China, the daughter of King Ghazur, lord of the islands and the seas and the seven palaces, was in like case. When her beauty had become known, and her name and fame been bruited abroad in the neighboring countries, all the kings had sent to her father to demand her of him in marriage. And he had consulted her on the matter, but she had disliked the very word wedlock. "O my father," she had answered, "I have no mind to marry. No, not at all. For I am a sovereign lady and a queen suzerain ruling over men, and I have no desire for a man who shall rule over me." And the more suits she refused, the more her suitors' eagerness increased, and all the royalties of the inner islands of China sent presents and rarities to her father with letters asking her in marriage. So he pressed her again and again with advice on the matter of espousals. But she ever opposed to him refusals, till at last she turned upon him angrily and cried, "O my father, if thou name matrimony to me once more, I will go into my chamber and take a sword and, fixing its hilt on the ground, will set its point to my waist. Then will I press upon it, till it come forth from my back, and so slay myself." Now when the king heard these words, the light became darkness in his sight, and his heart burned for her as with a flame of fire, because he feared lest she should kill herself. And he was filled with perplexity concerning her affair and the kings her suitors. So he said to her, "If thou be determined not to marry, and there be no help for it, abstain from going and coming in and out." Then he placed her in a house and shut her up in a chamber, appointing 10 old women as duennas to guard her, and forbade her to go forth to the 7 palaces. Moreover, he made it appear that he was incensed against her, and sent letters to all the kings, giving them to know that she had been stricken with madness by the jinn. With the hero and the heroine both following the negative way, and between them the continent of Asia, it will require a miracle to consummate the union of this eternally predestined pair. Whence can such a power come to break the life-negating spell and dissolve the wrath of the 2 childhood fathers? The reply to this question would remain the same throughout the mythologies of the world. For as is written so frequently in the sacred pages of the Quran, "Well able is Allah to save." The sole problem is what the machinery of the miracle is to be. And that is a secret to be opened only in the following stages of this Arabian Nights entertainment. 3. Supernatural Aid. For those who have not refused the call, the first encounter of the hero journey is with a protective figure, often a little old crone or old man, who provides the adventurer with amulets against the dragon forces he is about to pass. An East African tribe, for example, the Wachaga of Tanganyika, tell of a very poor man named Kayazimba, who set out in desperation for the land where the sun rises. And he had traveled long and grown tired, and was simply standing, looking hopelessly in the direction of his search, when he heard someone approaching from behind. He turned and perceived a decrepit little woman. She came up and wished to know his business. When he had told her, she wrapped her garment around him and, soaring from the earth, transported him to the zenith, where the sun pauses in the middle of the day. Then with a mighty din, a great company of men came from eastward to that place, and in the midst of them was a brilliant chieftain, who, when he had arrived, slaughtered an ox and sat down to feast with his retainers. The old woman asked his help for Kayazimba. The chieftain blessed the man and sent him home. And it is recorded that he lived in prosperity ever after. Among the American Indians of the Southwest, the favorite personage in this benignant role is Spider Woman, a grandmotherly little dame who lives underground. the twin war gods of the Navajo, on the way to the house of their father, the Sun, had hardly departed from their home following a holy trail, when they came upon this wonderful little figure.
The boys traveled rapidly in the holy trail, and soon after sunrise, near Tzilnautil, saw smoke arising from the ground. They went to the place where the smoke rose, and they found it came from the smoke hole of a subterranean chamber. A ladder, black from smoke, projected through the hole. Looking down into the chamber, they saw an old woman, the Spider Woman, who glanced up at them and said, "Welcome, children. Enter. Who are you? And whence do you come together walking?" They made no answer, but descended the ladder. When they reached the floor, she again spoke to them, asking, "Whither do you two go walking together?" "Nowhere in particular," they answered. "We came here because we had nowhere else to go." She asked this question four times, and each time she received a similar answer. Then she said, "Perhaps you would seek your father?" "Yes," they answered, "if we only knew the way to his dwelling." "Ah," said the woman, "it is a long and dangerous way to the house of your father, the Sun. There are many monsters dwelling between here and there, and perhaps, when you get there, your father may not be glad to see you, and may punish you for coming. You must pass four places of danger: the rocks that crush the traveller, the reeds that cut him to pieces, the cane cactuses that tear him to pieces, and the boiling sands that overwhelm him. But I shall give you something to subdue your enemies and preserve your lives." She gave them a charm called Feather of the Alien Gods, which consisted of a hoop with two life feathers, feathers plucked from a living eagle, attached, and another life feather to preserve their existence. She taught them also this magic formula, which, if repeated to their enemies, would subdue their anger. "Put your feet down with pollen, put your hands down with pollen, put your head down with pollen. Then your feet are pollen, your hands are pollen, your body is pollen, your mind is pollen, your voice is pollen. The trail is beautiful. Be still."
Pollen is a symbol of spiritual energy among the American Indians of the Southwest. It is used profusely in all ceremonials, both to drive evil away and to mark out the symbolical path of life. The helpful crone and fairy godmother is a familiar feature of European fairy lore. In Christian saints' legends, the role is commonly played by the Virgin. The Virgin, by her intercession, can win the mercy of the Father. Spider Woman, with her web, can control the movements of the Sun. The hero who has come under the protection of the Cosmic Mother cannot be harmed. The threat of Ariadne brought Theseus safely through the adventure of the labyrinth. This is the guiding power that runs through the work of Dante in the female figures of Beatrice and the Virgin, and appears in Goethe's Faust successively as Gretchen, Helen of Troy, and the Virgin. "Thou art the living fount of hope," prays Dante at the end of his safe passage through the perils of the three worlds. "Lady, thou art so great and so availest that whoso would have grace and has not recourse to thee would have his desire fly without wings. Thy benignity not only succors him who asks, but oftentimes freely foreruns the asking. In thee, mercy, in thee, pity, in thee, magnificence, in thee, whatever of goodness is in any creature, are united." What such a figure represents is the benign, protecting power of destiny. The fantasy is a reassurance, a promise that the peace of paradise, which was known first within the mother womb, is not to be lost, that it supports the present and stands in the future as well as in the past, is Omega as well as Alpha, that Though omnipotence may seem to be endangered by the threshold passages and life awakenings, protective power is always and ever present within the sanctuary of the heart, and even imminent within, or just behind, the unfamiliar features of the world. One has only to know and trust, and the ageless guardians will appear. Having responded to his own call, and continuing to follow courageously as the consequences unfold, the hero finds all the forces of the unconscious at his side. Mother Nature herself supports the mighty task. And insofar as the hero's act coincides with that for which his society itself is ready, he seems to ride on the great rhythm of the historical process. "I feel myself," said Napoleon at the opening of his Russian campaign, "driven towards an end that I do not know. As soon as I shall have reached it, as soon as I shall become unnecessary, an atom will suffice to shatter me. Till then, not all the forces of mankind can do anything against me." Not infrequently, the supernatural helper is masculine in form. In fairy lore, it may be some little fellow of the wood, some wizard, hermit, shepherd, or smith who appears to supply the amulets and advice that the hero will require. The higher mythologies develop the role in the great figure of the guide, the teacher, the ferryman, the conductor of souls to the afterworld. In classical myth, this is Hermes Mercury. In Egyptian, usually Thoth, the ibis god, the baboon god. In Christian, the Holy Ghost. Goethe presents the masculine guide in Faust as Mephistopheles. And not infrequently, the dangerous aspect of the mercurial figure is stressed, for he is the lurer of the innocent soul into realms of trial. In Dante's vision, the part is played by Virgil, who yields to Beatrice at the threshold of paradise. Protective and dangerous, motherly and fatherly at the same time, this supernatural principle of guardianship and direction unites in itself all the ambiguities of the unconscious, thus signifying the support of our conscious personality by that other larger system, but also the inscrutability of the guide that we are following to the peril of all our rational ends.
The following dream supplies a vivid example of the fusion of opposites in the unconscious. I dreamed that I had gone into a street of brothels, and to one of the girls. As I entered, she changed into a man, who was lying half-clothed on a sofa. He said, "It doesn't disturb you that I am now a man." The man looked old, and he had white sideburns. He reminded me of a certain chief forester who was a good friend of my father. All dreams, Dr. Stekel observes, have a bisexual tendency. Where the bisexuality cannot be perceived, it is hidden in the latent dream content.
The hero to whom such a helper appears is typically one who has responded to the call. The call, in fact, was the first announcement of the approach of this initiatory priest. But even to those who apparently have hardened their hearts, the supernatural guardian may appear. For, as we have seen, well able is Allah to save. And so it happened, as it were by chance, that in the ancient and deserted tower, where Kamar al-Zaman, the Persian prince, lay sleeping, there was an old Roman well. And this was inhabited by a jinnia of the seed of Iblis the Accursed, by name Maimuna, daughter of Al-Dimiryat, a renowned king of the jinn.
Compare Maimuna the jinn to the frog of the fairy tale. In pre-Mohammedan Arabia, the jinn, singular masculine jinni, feminine jinnia, were haunting demons of the deserts and wilderness. Hairy and misformed, or else shaped as animals, ostriches, or serpents, they were very dangerous to unprotected persons. The Prophet Muhammad admitted the existence of these heathen spirits and incorporated them in the Muhammadan system, which recognizes three created intelligences under Allah: angels formed of light, jinn of subtle fire, and man of the dust of the earth. The Muhammadan jinn have the power of putting on any form they please, but not grosser than the essence of fire and smoke, and they can thus make themselves visible to mortals. There are three orders of jinn: flyers, walkers, and divers. Many are supposed to have accepted the true faith, and these are regarded as good. The rest are bad. The latter dwell and work in close association with the fallen angels, whose chief is Iblis, the despairer.
And as Kamar al-Zaman continued sleeping till the first third of the night, Maimuna came up out of the Roman well and made for the firmament, thinking to listen by stealth to the converse of the angels. But when she reached the mouth of the well, and saw a light shining in the tower room, contrary to custom, she marveled, drew nigh, entered within the door, and beheld the couch spread, whereon was a human form with a wax candle burning at his head, and the lantern at his feet. She folded her wings and stood by the bed, and drawing back the coverlid, discovered Kamar al-Zaman's face, and she was motionless for a full hour in admiration and wonderment. "Blessed be Allah," she exclaimed when she recovered, "the best of creators," for she was of the true believing jinn. Then she promised herself that she would do no hurt to Kamar al-Zaman, and became concerned lest, resting in this desert place, he should be slain by one of her relatives, the Merids. An ifrit, ifrita, is a powerful jinni, jinnia. The Merids are a particularly powerful and dangerous class of jinn. Bending over him, she kissed him between the eyes, and presently drew back the sheet over his face. And after a while she spread her wings, and, soaring into the air, flew upwards, till she drew near to the lowest of the heavens. Now, as chance or destiny would have it, the soaring ifrita, Maimuna, suddenly heard in her neighborhood the noisy flapping of wings. Directing herself by the sound, she found it coming from an ifrit called Danash. So she swooped down on him like a sparrow hawk, and when he was aware of her, and knew her to be Maimuna, the daughter of the king of the jinn, he was sore afraid, and his side muscles quivered, and he implored her to forbear. But she challenged him to declare whence he should be coming at this hour of the night. He replied that he was returning from the islands of the inland sea in the parts of China, the realms of King Gayur, lord of the islands and the seas and the seven palaces. "There," said he, "I saw a daughter of his, than whom Allah hath made none fairer in her time." And he launched into great praise of the Princess Budur. Said he,
"She hath a nose like the edge of a burnished blade, and cheeks like purple wine or anemones blood red. Her lips as coral and cornelian shine, and the water of her mouth is sweeter than old wine. Its taste would quench hell's fiery pain. Her tongue is moved by wit of high degree and ready repartee. Her breast is seduction to all that see. Glory be to him who fashioned it and finished it, and joined thereto are two upper arms, smooth and rounded, even as saith of her the poet Al-Walahan, she has wrist hearts, which, did her bangles not contain, would run from out her sleeves in silvern rain.
The celebration of her beauty continued, and when Maimuna had heard it all, she remained silent in astonishment. Danash resumed and described the mighty king, her father, his treasures, and the seven palaces, as well as the history of the daughter's refusal to wed. "And I," said he, "O my lady, go to her every night and take my fill of feeding my sight on her face, and I kiss her between the eyes. Yet of my love to her, I do her no hurt." He desired Maimuna to fly back with him to China and look on the beauty, loveliness, stature, and perfection of proportion of the princess. "And after, if thou wilt," said he, "chastise me or enslave me, for it is thine to bid and to forbid." Maimuna was indignant that anyone should presume to celebrate any creature in the world, after the glimpse she had just had of Kamar al-Zaman. "Faugh! Faugh!" she cried. She laughed at Danash and spat in his face. "Verily, this night I have seen a young man," said she, "whom, if thou saw, though but in a dream, thou wouldst be palsied with admiration, and spittle would flow from thy mouth." And she described his case. Danash expressed his disbelief that anyone could be more handsome than the Princess Budur, and Maimuna commanded him to come down with her and look. "I hear, and I obey," said Danash. And so they descended and alighted in the salon. Maimuna stationed Danash beside the bed and, putting out her hand, drew back the silken coverlet from Kamar al-Zaman's face, when it glittered and glistened and shimmered and shone like the rising sun. She gazed at him for a moment, then, turning sharply round upon Danash, said, "Look, O accursed, and be not the basest of madmen. I am a maid, yet my heart he hath waylaid." "By Allah, O my lady, thou art excusable," declared Danash. "But there is yet another thing to be considered, and that is that the estate female differeth from the male. By Allah's might, this, thy beloved, is the likest of all created things to my mistress in beauty and loveliness and grace and perfection, and it is as though they were both cast alike in the mold of seemly head." The light became darkness in Maimuna's sight when she heard those words, and she dealt Danash with her wing so fierce a buffet on the head as well nigh made an end of him. "I conjure thee," she commanded, "by the light of my love's glorious countenance, go at once, O accursed, and bring hither thy mistress, whom thou lovest so fondly and foolishly, and return in haste that we may lay the twain together, and look at them both as they lie asleep, side by side. So shall it appear to us which be the goodlier and more beautiful of the two." And so, incidentally to something going on in a zone of which he was entirely unconscious, the destiny of the life-reluctant Kamar al-Zaman began to fulfill itself, without the cooperation of his conscious will. 4. The Crossing of the First Threshold. With the personifications of his destiny to guide and aid him, the hero goes forward in his adventure until he comes to the Threshold Guardian at the entrance to the zone of magnified power. Such custodians bound the world in the four directions, also up and down, standing for the limits of the hero's present sphere, or life horizon. Beyond them is darkness, the unknown, and danger. just as beyond the parental watch is danger to the infant, and beyond the protection of his society, danger to the member of the tribe. The usual person is more than content. He is even proud to remain within the indicated bounds, and popular belief gives him every reason to fear